Welcome to Public Square, Conversations in Democracy, where we explore the heart of democracy. I'm your host, Witte van Renswijk, on a mission to reboot the public sector and invigorate local democracies worldwide. Join us as we spotlight game changers, share visions and practical innovations. Let's begin today's inspiring conversation.
Hi, everyone, and hi, Witte. Good to be back together for yet another episode. How have you been? What's been going on this week?
Hey, Vanya. Good to see you again. It's been a busy week, but an interesting week. On Tuesday, I went to the OECD in Paris at a conference. Met a lot of people from who are working on civic tech, on citizen participation. So it's always inspiring to meet new people and meet old friends again. And lots of interesting thoughts coming out of it, a lot of food for thought that I would definitely like to recycle for our podcast guests and for us to talk about. So that's what happened on my end. How was your week?
Yeah, it was pretty great. I've been excited that we get to talk to Steve from Luxembourg and prepping for the episode and the conversation. And also there's been quite a few reports coming out about participatory democracy, so I've been diving into those for some insights, especially as more and more elections are coming up and people are gearing up for them. So I'm curious if that came up at your conference, the fact that 2024 will be full of elections around the world.
Yeah, that's one part, although we have focused more on participatory democracy than on like the more electoral democracy. I think for me, like two points that stood out from the conference is one, we talk a lot about local government and what is happening at the local level and not so much at the national level. So that's why I'm excited to actually talk or speak with Steve today. There was a lot of like debate around why that is actually the case, because they had a lot of representatives from national level, from Brazil and Portugal. So that is something very interesting, I think. The other thing was definitely that technology is one thing, but what's more important is culture, a culture of democracy, a culture of engagement, and that is something to nurture over months and years. And so that's another thing I would definitely like to dig into with Steve.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm also curious how you approach internal organization if you're doing engagement at the national level. It just seems like a lot to navigate.
Shall we listen to what Steve has to say about this?
Let's get into it.
Today, we're traveling to one of the smallest European countries. We're traveling to Luxembourg. It's a fascinating nation known for its linguistic diversity. And interestingly enough, it's the world's only Grand Duchy, a Grand Duke. So yes, it is a monarchy that is reigned by a Grand Duke, something I didn't really realize. But it's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about community engagement and citizen participation. And we'll be doing that with Steve Glanche, who is leading the community engagement efforts at the national level. So very warm welcome to you, Steve.
Hello, Witte, and thank you for the invitation.
Steve, well, to kick things off, I would like to go back in time. Could you start by sharing your earliest memory of democracy with us?
Gosh, the earliest. And then we go back, far back in time. I guess the earliest I really can remember was at high school, you know, when then the class speaker is elected. And then I also noticed that those who shout the loudest got elected, but they were not always the best one.
Okay. So, and specifically in the classroom, you said?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's generally was... Then I guess it was always the second day of school. And so, I mean, when you're not aware of it and you don't know anything, it's difficult to apprehend. And I guess it's a little bit like in real life, when you are not educated or not prepared, then participation and democracy is hard, it's difficult to do.
And so you had local politicians coming into the classroom. Did I get that right?
No, it's inside the class when you elect the class speaker for your class, for your high school class. Sorry for that.
Oh, yeah, that kind of, all right. Interesting. Yeah, that's also democracy. I was thinking about politics, but that's also democracy. All right. Well, Steve, We're going to be talking about citizen participation at a national level. And I want to actually start off by sharing a personal anecdote and an observation with you. So this week, I was on a panel at the OECD in Paris, and we talked about the state of civic technology and participatory democracy. And interestingly enough, we all came to the conclusion that most of the success stories so far of civic technology and citizen participation, they're almost always at the local level as opposed to the national level. And I would like to ask you, what are your reflections on why that would be the case? Why is there more citizen participation and online citizen participation happening at a local level? And why do we have fewer cases at a national level so far?
Well, that's a good question, and also a good conclusion. I would say on the local level, you are closer with your constituents. And so you, on the one hand, you have to engage more with them. And on the other hand, you get more information from them in order to shape the politics, the policies which are dealing with them. And on the other hand, also, you have a direct effect. I mean, the politics have a direct visible effect. Whereas on the national level, you more or less you give the strategy, the direction, and very often you cannot apprehend what is happening at a local level. So it's sometimes it's a good guess what on national policy level is happening, but it gives the basis, and it needs to be a good base, because if the base work is well done, then also on the local level it can they can work on it. This means when the rules of the games are well defined on the national level, then on the local level it the game can be played and there will not be too many fouls.
Right. And how does that, I think you had an interesting point in there, which is like, yeah, we're working on like a longer timeline, right? Like it's hard to see immediately the effects of your participation. How do you have any tactics? And the moment we're going to start talking about, of course, the work that you're doing in Luxembourg, but do you have any concrete tactics of how you're actually adapting to that reality of like those longer cycles? In other words, how are you organizing citizen participation differently at the national level than you would typically see at a local level?
Now, I have to say that here in Luxembourg, I mean, on the local level, like the municipalities, the communes, they have a certain autonomy, though they are managed by the Ministry of the Interior, but they have a certain autonomy in certain areas. And we have seen here in Luxembourg that many communes went into city participation for establishing a little bit, let's say, okay, how should the village or the city center be conceived? Because in Luxembourg we have a plan for the building and the real estate, which is on the major part is framed on the national level. But then on the local level, there are some specificities which come in. And this year, and I guess also last year, we saw a lot of workshops happening in the communes where they were asked, okay, the commune has bought this plot of land, and how would you like to see it developed? That was really one-to-one. So it was an information session, and then there was a workshop on a Saturday morning or so. And then afterwards there was, I shall say, a document which generally comes out as a summary. And it's not that everything is taken up, but it gives an indication to the local policy makers, okay, what the citizens are expecting from them. That's on the local level. On the national level, it's a little bit different because you have so many constituents and you cannot dwell so deep into the details like on the local level.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to get back to that topic later on. But we're in this conversation, we're going to be talking about obviously the Luxembourgish context. We're also going to be talking about internal change that you got to bring. But before we get into all of that, could you tell us a little more about the community engagement work you've been doing so far in Luxembourg and the impact that you've had so far with your participation program?
Let's say so. The community engagement we are trying to do, because we are in the very early stages and also on the lower steps of a hopefully exponential, how should I say, hockey stick-like learning phase. We are building on what has been done all the years, but so far community engagement has just been, how shall I say, a lip belief. This means it has been in the governmental program, it has been mentioned, it's coming down from the European Commission that you need to engage your stakeholders more and so on and so on. And so we at the administrative reform, I mean, we are a team of two, my colleague Martin and myself. We are trying to get the, how shall I say, the culture of engagement first into the civil servants, and then also to get the citizens, the stakeholders, the external stakeholders involved. The thing is, with the civil servants, what we did so far is with each civil servant we have been in contact, they want to do it. They are longing for community engagement, to get feedback, to talk to the stakeholders. And from the stakeholders, it's the same, but very often you notice that the language is different, they are talking. So there we need to do some further education on that side. On the other side also, as I said, the civil servants, the operative ones, they are very open. They would be, and they are also the drivers, whereas they're, as a little bit touch on, there's not a clear mandate for community engagement, unfortunately, that from, let's say, a little bit higher managerial or the hierarchy level, it's a little bit, it's not blocked, but it's not on their priority lists. So that's why we are doing it step by step and a little bit under the radar, let's call it.
But first, I want to get a bit more into, you know, the actual work you're doing. So as you said, you're working on administrative reform. And I think as a community member, yes, it is very important, but it's probably not the most sexy topic to engage on, right? I don't know whether you would agree or not, but how do you make such a often, I imagine, technical and policy-driven program, how do you make that tangible and relatable to your community?
What we try to do is to act by example, to show by example, to take small examples or small projects in order that they get acquainted, and not trying to go immediately for with a huge material or huge machines, but with small machine. Instead of taking the caterpillar, we are taking the shovel. Mm-hmm. And we even start with the shovel which you used in your rose garden, not the big one which you're using on the street works. So we try to do it step by step with small project. I guess we get a little bit later on also on one or the other examples we had. But it's really, we really started during the pandemic, that where we had time and we could do a lot of things, prepare a lot of things. And then we also got some tools in order to do it. So for the time being, it's a very, a lot is done online. It's not so much, unfortunately, physically. But we see that the physical approach is well received if we talk about it. And we also did a few, one or the other pilot with, for example, we had chosen to say, okay, we take a live event. For example, if you there's a death in your family, or when a child is born, and the two of us, we sit down, we did a desk research, we contacted one or the other administrations in order to really get a little bit the user journey. And from that, we once did a workshop, a half-day workshop, in order to get it validated from one or the other administration which is involved in the process. And we noticed that they really wanted and they were eager to do it. And what we heard very often is, yes, that these are our thoughts, and yes, we have thought about it and we proposed it already, or they had a few years ago, or 10 years ago or so, there had been already an incentive to do it, but it has been, for X, Y, or Z reason, it has not gone forward. So this means, to answer your question, we do it step by step, and we try to select cases or projects which are not too big, which are what I generally call low-hanging fruits, and which do not hurt anybody. So that if it isn't done, it's not so much of a hassle. And if it's done, it is not so in, how shall I say, immersive, either on the stakeholder side, the external stakeholder side, or the internal stakeholder side.
So, am I right to assume that a lot of the administrative reforms are then directly linked to service delivery, better service delivery? I mean, you just gave an example of like a death certificate, whatever it might be, right?
Most of them, Emma, because these are the ones which are tangible. And as I have to add that also, we try to have tangible business cases or tangible projects. On the other hand, there's also, if you look at the European level, when you say administrative reform, it's closely linked to better regulation. There is also to see, okay, you have this administrative burden reduction and so on. And there it's clearly linked to, okay, which administrative processes are the most burdenful for the stakeholders and which one are the most complex. A little bit like in France, you have this baromètre, the démarche complexe, and which is really beautiful. And that was something which we would love to have here in Luxembourg. But again, it's very political because on the one hand, you need a mandate. On the other hand, if you have something, you show something. And then on the one hand, you have to be honest to yourself that it's not all perfect. It's not all to do it better, but that's why we generally say it's not to simplify, but to do it in a more adapted manner. That's how we see it.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that barometer that you were talking about? What is that exactly?
In France, they have what they call le baromètre, let's say, so a ranking of the administrative processes which the stakeholders, the external stakeholders, deem complex. And they do it, I don't know if it's every year or every second year, they do a ranking.
Interesting.
And based on that ranking, they pick the top ones, or according to a certain quadrant and so on, they select one, and then to see, okay, why are they considered complex? Often it could be just the language which is used. Often it's the steps which are involved. Often it's the flow, because maybe the flow is, you go in to, instead of going to A to C, you go A, B, D, E, C, and something like that. And that's where they work on. And then the following evaluation, they look at it and they look, okay, these have been the top five, and now the top five are these ones. Ah, okay, we managed to reduce the complexity or the perceived complexity
Right.
of the administrative processes.
You were previously talking about the different tools that you use, Steve. So you kind of insisted on the fact that, hey, we use both online and offline. Could you tell us a little more about what's been your approach so far and what's been the benefits of deploying also digital tools?
The digital tool enables in the preparatory phase to gather already the temperature, to gather interest from the stakeholders, and to frame, okay, the case you are working on, or trying to frame the problem. And on the other hand, if you go into the physical and exercise, you have to face to face, and you get more input, you get more tangible input, and there's less losing of, the message you would each party wants to communicate. Right. Not everybody can be there on the physical area. You go back to the, let's say, online area, where you can then get a further input on what you have developed. So really, you can. Everybody has time to reflect and to see how it's evolving. It's really transparent, and it's also breaking down the barriers to participation. So I would say both. Both are very important, and when I say hybrid, I don't mean that you have a physical and then an online at the same time. That also can happen, but it's a whole. We see that you need both, because with the advantage with an online tools is you can keep the information, you can see how the story, the timeline. Whereas very often on the physical one, it's not a one-off, but your attendees warm up, you get to the meet, then you have a conclusion, you slow down, and then it's a little bit forgotten.
Right.
And that's why we see it as important to have both.
That makes a lot of sense. Online offering the process transparency, offering like low-key engagement, getting more people involved, and then getting into the depth during those offline meetings. That makes a lot of sense. Well, next I would like to talk a little bit more about the specific context you're dealing with in Luxembourg. So one of the fascinating things about Luxembourg is obviously it's linguistic diversity. So you've got three official languages, right? Luxembourgish, French, German. So let's talk a little more about how you deal with those language dynamics and like just setting up a public debate in multiple languages. So can you tell us a little more about this specific topic of how you deal with all those different languages and civic engagement?
Thank you. That's a good point, a good question. Because when you're in Luxembourg, you're used to it, so it's not so special to yourself. And let's say you're right, in Luxembourg, okay, our national language is Luxembourgish. But as you said, on the administrative side, you have French, German, and Luxembourgish, which are used. But all our laws and regulations are in French. When you're dealing with external stakeholders, they can use the three official languages, and then they are answered in the three official languages, either by letter, email, and so on. Though the French, if you refer to a law or an article, it's always the French which has a legal binding value. On the other hand, getting back to the engagement is there again, the online tool enables us to use different languages. For example, our online tool is in one, two, three, in four languages. It's Luxembourgish, German, French, and English. And that allows us to talk to, let's say, more than the majority of the population in Luxembourg on the one hand. And so, okay, it's also more work for us because each time we put something up, we have to do it in the four languages. But the beauty is what we noticed, each stakeholder who participated, they participated between quotation marks in their language, one of the four languages. And it was seamless. We replied or commented then in a language they posted. But on the other hand, and that's only possible online, is that the other stakeholders who eventually are not so fluent in one or the other languages, they could either use if there's a translation in the online tool, or you have so many translation features in on other website where you copy paste it and then you get the understanding, and it really helps to get there. I would say without using the online channel, it would have been very difficult to get the engagement. On, we notice also, for example, when we do go on the physical engagement, we have to be ready to have the four languages, to talk the language, that the facilitators are able to talk the four languages. Because the thing is, if you go on the physical engagement, you have two options. Either you do the tables according to language preferences, but then maybe you get a certain cultural fit and it's uniform. You don't get this wealth, the cultural wealth, which could provide and assist in digging deeper into the problem and defining it and then finding a potential solution. Or you say, okay, we make disparate tables with different languages. And so the facilitator, which is on the table, has also the task not only to facilitate, but also to be able to communicate. Because that's my belief is more or less everybody here who is working and living here in Luxembourg understands and can more or less communicate in one of the four languages. I say communicate, not talking or speaking, but communicate. And for such a workshop, very often it's more than enough. It's just to get your idea and then you can elaborate together. And on the physical one, I mean, anyway, you draw, you write, you post it and you prototype and so on. So that works. I mean, it's like with children. Here in Luxembourg, I mean, I grew up, we were in the kindergarten, I think we were two who were from their nationality, I mean, from in the family, we would talk Luxembourgish. The others was Welsh. I mean, it was Portuguese, Italian, German, French, Icelandic, Danish, Greek, and so on. It was marvelous. And we could communicate with each other. We played with each other. And that is also what we need to get into it, to get this playfulness again.
No, I think that's fascinating, and it's probably, I mean, Luxembourg in that sense, it's a mini Europe, right? Where language becomes a tool to, as you said, like to communicate. It might not be the perfect way for us all to express whatever, the deepest emotions we might have, but something very recognizable here in Belgium, of course, as well. You also mentioned that I heard you saying like people who either live or work in Luxembourg. And you've told me once that you have about, if I got it right, like about 200,000 commuters each day coming into the country, right? What is how many people do you have in Luxembourg? 1.5 million something or less?
A little bit more than I think we are around 700, 600 or
Oh,
700,000 in
okay.
Luxembourg.
Yeah, then you've got 1/3 of basically your daily population, if you want. Or probably a quarter that is actually commuters. But so my question to you is Steve, how do you, how and why, maybe there's also a why question there. Why do you in the first place also get, commuters, stakeholders involved who are not strictly speaking a citizen, but who clearly have a stake? And yeah, how do you cater your public services to their needs as well?
That's a good one as well. The first, we need to do it because, I mean, we are relying on these commuters. But just giving a little bit the basic. It's Luxembourg, we are a small country and we rely on the commuters on the surrounding neighbors. This means Germany, France, and Belgium. So we rely on them. We need them that our economy works. And on the other hand, as they are working in Luxembourg, they also make the economy around Luxembourg work, where they are living. So it would be make no sense not to cater the services to them because they are using them as well. They are using the public transport. They are using probably also the children benefits for schooling and so on. So that's why we have the three different official languages. I mean, it's via the languages that we can cater to them. And of course, we need to listen to them. And they are also the ones who use the public services more. The commuters, they need to do the proactively, they need to do actions with the administrations. So the public services delivered by these administrations need, of course, to cater to them. And how we do that, I mean, we have a lot of work still to do. I mean, we have an awareness now. I don't want to say since a few years, has always been a latent awareness. But now it's getting official, also on the policy level and the policy makers, how important the commuters are, both on the cultural level and also on the economical level. So, and hopefully it will increase in parallel with delivering public services to the residents and to the non-residents.
All right, that's insightful. I want us to shift gears for a moment, and I want to talk about, because we talked a lot about, you know, how to engage a community, more the external aspect. I would like to look inwards next, and I want to talk about the changes that come along with doing community engagement. Can you tell us a little more, Steve, about the challenges and the obstacles that you have encountered in your work, in getting your colleagues in the different departments along, and how you've navigated these?
Okay, thank you. Let's say, so the major challenge we notice, and which is still there, to be honest, is to really get a mandate for adapting, for going, for looking, for adaptation, potential adaptations, and to also engage. That's on one hand. And on the other hand, the culture is not yet there for getting the engagement internally, I mean. As I said, those who are on the operational side, of course they want, but how? And you need to manage expectations. And there, you know, we need to do a lot. When I say education, it doesn't mean that we have to train them to do it, but to get the mindset, to educate, to give the capacity for engaging. And that's something which still has to be done. What we did, for example, we had in Luxembourg, when you become a civil servant, there are some trainings which you need to undergo. And we had it in part in one of these trainings. There was 45 minutes or so to talk about, okay, what is administrative reform? What is administrative simplification, better regulation? What does it involve? What is public services? What is it? My definition is that the word service is so important. The thing is to get the right public service. This means the service the stakeholders are expecting and that they need. This means the adequate service to the stakeholders in the adequate manner and at the right time. So that is to explain this to the newbies. And also we did a very small service design workshop explaining them the user journey and also then the empathy part. And it was marvelous, but that was in the beginning, very early. And then, okay, there have been the COVID, there have been changes, the government changes and so on. So it fell a little bit down. It has been watered down. But what we learned is that we need to go that way, that path, to give the capacity to the internal stakeholders to be able to assess by themselves, I come morning, it's Monday morning, come to the office, I look in my in-tray and I am already sick, really sick, I'm fed up for the whole week. And then in order to be fed up for the whole week, just say, okay, why are you fed up of the whole week? Why in your in-tray? You take out the in-tray, you look, okay. And then you say, yeah, but this is again the wrong form. This is the form is not right. It's not filled in. There are not the good documents, proof. Oh, it shouldn't be here. It should first go to get the stamp of this one and so on. And then to look into it, okay, the why. And then, okay, but how can it be adapted? How can I adapt it? And that is something what I mean by capacity building.
If I can paraphrase here for a moment. What you're saying is, because you started off by saying we need a clear mandate, and then you went into like, because we need a culture and we need the right mindset to do participation. But actually, what you're saying is, I see colleagues around me who have the willingness to do this, but they need the capacity, they need the resources, they need the time to be able to do this. So, am I right to summarize it that way, to say all we need is a clear, top level mandate that we can spend our time on this, that we get the resources to do citizen participation, and then from there we will start building that culture of participation. So that is why you would prioritize.
Yes, I would say, yeah, you really nailed it.
And well, then we gotta dig into that mandate, obviously, because I feel we're getting to like the holy grail here. So on the mandate, what do you see today as the obstacles on why, and I guess the mandate, then you're talking about the political leadership, right? Decision makers. So what is keeping them potentially from giving that mandate?
Let's see. So it's maybe not the political leadership which is who is refraining to give the mandate, but they are not aware of it. I mean, it's what we are talking about: community engagement, administrative reform, simplification, service design, and so on. That is something which is always, as I said, in the governmental plan, but it's like a stepchild. It's once there, it's once there, it's once there. In fact, the mandate could be in the form of saying, okay, now we have a new government. We elected it a few years ago, a few weeks ago. We had national elections, and the government is forming. And even to say, okay, let's take this step instead of putting it somewhere, trying to fit it somewhere, either into public services, either in digitalization, either into the justice also, to say, okay, let's make it transversal, and let's make it not top down but bottom up. Let's have this part a little bit like a service desk, that it's there, transversal. It is this service desk has the intelligence, the knowledge to provide you with the tools, the capacity to undertake it and to assist you in it, but not doing it for you. Not that you are still the owner, and also not trying to push it to say, okay, now you have to do this, 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 or now we do this benchmarking of complexity and you have to do something like that. No, that each a business unit, let's call it a business unit, or see it's a ministry or each administration on its own sees the benefit for it and doesn't see it as a burden or a cost, but more like something which enables them to do a better job for them and also to have a better satisfaction, a higher satisfaction level for themselves, because there's nothing more rewarding to deliver a good service to stakeholders who are thankful for it. And then you know, okay, you have done a good job. And therefore, I would say it's not so much that there's a block there, but it's more the how, that on the mandate, it's the form of this mandate, how it eventually could be. Coming back, you touch upon that you have been to the OECD the other day. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there, but I'm also a member of the OPSI, which is the Observatory of Public Service Innovation of the OECD. And there, one of the thing is, on the one hand, how to get innovation into it, service innovation, and how to measure it. And each time it comes back to mandate, and each time the mandate means something for different for everybody. Well, for the ones it's okay, we need to have a law, we have a new regulation. For the others is we just need to be able to do it. Let's enable us to do it. Sometimes also you don't need the resources, let's say, or a lot of resources. You just need willingness. So that's really something where again you have, it's depending on the maturity level of the different, let's say, governments or policy makers or policy frameworks. Let's call it like that, policy framework. It's not the people, but it's more the framework I'm talking about.
Right. Okay, so what I'd take away for sure is the making participation something transversal, and I would totally agree with that. It shouldn't sit within one single department, one single office. Although it can be a way, of course, to build early successes, and I think, I mean, that is what you're doing in Luxembourg as well, right? So you're starting out now working on administrative reform. Hopefully, next step is to make it more transversal. So let's talk a little more about that. So you started out with a pilot project. What would it now, or how could we take it to the, how could you take it to the mainstream? What would be needed for that?
To select cases which are appealing and which are talking to the different stakeholders, but which are maybe not key services or key processes, but which eventually make small change, where you can, with small changes, get a visible result. I guess that's there, one thing. On the other thing is, we also had beginning of the year what we call, we copied again from our French colleagues, the day of administrative simplification. And there again, we noticed a willingness among the internal stakeholders. It was internally, and on there we are now, I would say, to drill down and to do it a little bit in smaller groups instead of being doing a big one, but in smaller groups where we tackle one case, another case, to work with ad hoc groups, which are not really formalized, but a little bit ad hoc, where you say, okay, this is our objective, and this is more or less the way we give us to reach that objective. And of course, also involve external stakeholders, and not making it too big. Do it small, step by step, smaller gatherings, and so on, in order to see, okay, how can we learn? In order to learn what works and what doesn't work, or the do's and don'ts, and then to go to the next step and say, okay, now eventually we take a bigger one, and then we tackle the small parts. We then look for the nuts and bolts which we can screw in order to have the clock ticking more accurately, not faster, but accurately.
Well, I think that is a wonderful way to end this conversation, because I actually wanted to wrap up the conversation by asking you for one single piece of advice, but I think you just gave it. Taking small steps, getting to those cases, and then expanding step per step. Steve, thank you so much for sharing all your insights, all your tactics with us, and until next time.
Thank you very much, Vita. Until next time.
That was so inspiring to hear how they navigated a multilingual engagement approach, right? So they had various online and offline situations. And so whether they were running online ideation or hosting workshops of small conversations, it's really commendable that they focused on the fact that yes, we have three official languages and even a fourth that we use in practice. And we want to make sure that people can engage in the language that they're most comfortable with. I really hope that listening to Steve inspires other local governments to stop shying away from multilingual engagement. What are your thoughts, Wietse?
I agree, and I would also add to that what Steve also stresses, that the online realm offers opportunities to engage in your own language in multiple languages. And yeah, it's one of the benefits, I guess, like in an offline setting, it's you need a translator, you need someone that things might get lost a little more. So definitely one of the advantages of online. I find it also intriguing the idea of, in multilingual settings, how language is more seen as an instrument than, and how did he put that again? He said, like, it's not a language to, ex we don't use language to really deeply express, but to communicate and to get a message along. And that even sometimes if you need a drawing or a body language, these are also means of communicating. So I thought that was interesting. But what did you take away from like the multilingual discussion that we had?
Yeah, I also that point really stuck with me that really language is to communicate. And so however you end up communicating, Steve did some reflection on communicating in person with folks who are of all different backgrounds and of all different languages, and how at the end of the day, when you want to, you are able to communicate across different linguistic boundaries. And I think that was really special and really inspiring. And I also thought that it was really great how much effort they put into engaging everyone in their community. So language was one component of it, but the other was that he mentioned they have something like 200,000 commuters who come to work in Luxembourg but don't actually live there. And they're still, wanting to appreciate and recognize the people who are contributing to Luxembourg in that way and want to engage them. So they're looking at everything from, how does public transportation serve commuters to how do other services serve them? So I thought it was really commendable that they're truly trying to reach everyone who touches, impacts, and influences Luxembourg and its future.
There's a simple principle of, whenever one gets affected by a policy, they should be involved. I think that's a very easy but powerful leading principle, defining your audience. And, like this, obviously, years ago, we used to talk about citizen participation a lot, and would focus on the word citizen. But if you rethink, like, who should actually be part of the conversation, there are many more stakeholders than the strictly defined citizens. And I think Steve definitely proves that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that surprised me is that I was expecting to hear a lot of differences between what it looks like to do national level versus local level, but I ultimately think that almost all of Steve's tips could be implemented by any public servant, whether they're working at the local, national, or international level. And I think that's really surprising to me because I expected there to be many more differences. And I imagine, they're early in their process, so there could be a lot of nuances at that national level, but ultimately the tips in practice can be implemented anywhere.
Yeah, I could also feel or hear from the conversation there are still many challenges ahead, and I think they're probably pretty typical for working at national level. As he said, like, actually, I see a lot of, appetite to do more participation, but what we need is a clear mandate. We need the resources, we need the time to be able to do that, and we need ideally participation to sit at a transversal level, not just like within one department. So that's what I also believe to be like the right vision, but yeah, it's obviously easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm curious to hear if from other national level engagement practitioners. So if you're one of them, reach out to us and let us know how you are tackling engagement at the national level, wherever you are around the globe.
Thank you for joining us on our journey towards a democratic future. Subscribe to the podcast to stay connected. Next month, we'll be back with another trailblazer. And remember, democracy is a journey, it's not just a destination. Stay curious, engaged, and active in your local democracy. Until next time.